Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging.
I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I'm going to. Because that was perfect. That's me. I love it. It's a great challenge for you to look down every nook and cranny. I could be here forever. Just to put things in perspective. And I think that's a sign of a good detective.
This is the Narelle Fraser Conversations on Australian True Crime. Because women don't always have to be the subjects of true crime for all the worst reasons.
And I thought I was going to get pinged there and then.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
Just the numbers were just growing. And looking at it, you just thought there's no way you could survive. It was just, it was unreal.
Okay, my guest today was a member of Victoria Police for 22 years. She attained the rank of Detective Sergeant at Diamond Creek Socket Sex Offence and Child Abuse Investigative Team. She won 3AW's Police Person of the Year in 2002. She's what's called Participant Protection Manager at Racing Victoria. It's a newly created position to respond and investigate incidents of inappropriate conduct within the thoroughbred racing industry, such things as like, say, harassment, discrimination and workplace bullying. She was principal investigator at IBAC, the Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission. She was manager of investigations in the Northern Territory Office of the Children's Commissioner. She was a senior detective in Child Abuse Task Force in Northern Territory. And in the aftermath of 2009 Black Saturday, she was part of a team of police allocated duties at Strathewen, Arthur's Creek and St Andrews, beautiful little hamlets within about an hour from Melbourne CBD. And that is the subject of today's podcast. Today's podcast comes with a warning, though, to anyone affected by that day. Depending on where you are with your recovery or your management of your own personal issues. Today's story, it's a beautiful story, but it's also really confronting in other ways. And I'd have to say that listener caution is advised. Of the 200 residents who lived in Strathewen, 22 residents died. 22 out of 200. A further 14 residents of St Andrews lost their lives on that day, and another two at Arthur's Creek. These are tiny little hamlets. Strathewen is a gorgeous little Victorian town, a country town about 45 k's northeast of Melbourne, which was decimated on that day. And Bald Spur Road winds its way through bush up on a ridgeline from St Andrews to Kinglake Central. And on that road alone, 22 people lost their lives. So with a few scratch teams of police from Diamond Creek, their brief was to search for survivors, but unfortunately, there were very many. And instead, they were confronted with a large amount of human remains. What my guest today witnessed with her colleagues was a grief and sadness beyond comprehension to most of us, but an experience which connected her and her colleagues to this day, and it will forever. Yet through all this grief and sadness, it's a beautiful story, which is everything from heart-wrenching to heartwarming. Now, that's one hell of an introduction, and you will get to speak right now, Kira. So please welcome my very dear friend, Kira Olney. Welcome, Kira.
Thank you, my friend.
So I suppose we should start off for the listeners and give them a very, very brief rundown on, well, if I can be brief, I'll try, but on how we met. Kira and I met the 2000 Olympics, and we weren't participating. We were both at the squads in town. I was at Missing Persons. Where were you? Where were you,
no,
Kira?
I think you were at Sex Crimes, actually, Narelle. And I was at Missing. I was at Homicide.
Homicide, okay. And
it was before we started working together.
Yes, well, I didn't know you and you didn't know me from a bar of soap. I'd never even seen you around. So what they did was, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but they asked, the police were given the responsibility of what's called a liaison officer. So that was really for the Olympic teams that were coming to Melbourne to train and to play off for a medal in Sydney. How am I going so far? Is that about right?
Yeah, and that was for the soccer teams.
Oh, no, I think it was for a number of things. It wasn't just soccer. I think it was a whole lot of different things, baseball, all sorts of stuff. However, when the police asked for volunteers, thought it might be a bit of a break, bit of a holiday actually, and you felt the same, didn't you?
I did. I think the other alternative was that we were all taken offline, I suppose, for there was all the WEF demonstrations going on just prior. So I remember there was a bit of a choice that they were trying to get teams together to help either with WEF, which was all those horrible protests, or we could go the junket.
So we both go up to the 10th floor where they were choosing, you know, they were choosing who to work on which teams, who was liaison officer for which teams. And I'd been told, get onto the USA women's soccer team if you can, because they are like, they are world renowned. I didn't know a thing about soccer and neither did you.
Nope.
So I might let you take over from here. So we sat down at the desk at the big conference room, and I happened to sit next to this blonde girl I'd never seen before.
That's right. And I remember you saying, I think you actually elbowed me and said, hey, whispered to me, I've heard the US soccer girls team's the team to go with. Would you be interested? Okay. I didn't really know anything. So I thought, oh, here this lovely lady's asking me to join her. She seemed pretty friendly. I thought, yeah, why not? And then, yeah, then I think you put up your hand and said, yes, we'll do that. I don't think we even knew each other's names, but
no, we didn't.
Went off to the Hilton, drove down to the Hilton and met the team. And that was, I think, when they came on the bus. I think that was early days. But, yeah, obviously that was our first introduction to each other, as well as the American girls soccer team. And, wow, look what's happened.
Yeah. And so I might start off with a few questions about that very impressive career. It does sound interesting, your role that you're now doing at Racing Victoria. I believe that's a whole new department. Can you tell us what that position entails and why your position was created?
It was basically created on the back of recommendations made by the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse, where they developed some child safety national principles, and that expanded, well, that included sporting organisations. Because racing, the industry, has quite a few young, vulnerable people in it, Victoria saw it as a bit of a an area that they needed to develop. So thankfully for me, they created this position. So I sit within the integrity department that manage any cases that might come in or concerns about participants that have endured or getting harassed or sexually harassed or workplace bullying, that sort of thing. So it's evolving. But I also manage the speak up policy, which is similar to the whistleblowers policy. So we're trying to encourage people to come forward about improper conduct and misconduct in the industry.
And then your roles in Northern Territory, they must have been so difficult on so many levels, because they involve kids, children, and more often than not, those kids, I imagine most of them that came to your notice would be vulnerable, I suppose many disadvantaged, neglected, and really it doesn't get much sadder than that, does it?
No, it was a bit of an eye-opener for me. I mean, I'd been in police and sort of specialised in child abuse for probably 6 years prior to going up to the NT, and I sort of went there thinking that it's, you know, that I basically had come across anything and everything. But once up there, it certainly opened my eyes. I had no idea the scale of child abuse. I did a lot of remote work whilst I was at the Child Abuse Task Force, but yeah, there was some things that you just thought, oh gosh, I can't believe that sort of happened, but unfortunately they did.
What did you find most challenging about working up in NT?
Probably the level of abuse for the very, very young, like I'm talking 2-year-olds, that sort of thing. That was what was quite confronting for me. I hadn't seen that level of abuse down in Victoria, but that was something that, yeah, I found quite challenging.
Is there a situation or investigation that you've had trouble forgetting?
Yeah, look, there's been, I think one, yeah, that I really struggled with actually happened after I'd left the Child Abuse Task Force and gone over to the Children's Commission, but been working with a young girl at a remote community. We'd started to make headway in getting an understanding of what was happening to her, because they're very reluctant to disclose. That's a really big challenge. But we finally got her to start disclosing, and so we were getting an understanding of what was going on. And then, yeah, I just transferred across to the Children's Commission and found out that she actually committed suicide. So didn't a way out, really hard to deal with, because I thought that we were making inroads, and, you know, was sort of hoping that we could continue helping her and getting her out of that environment. But, yeah, unfortunately she took her own life, so.
Is there an investigation where you felt you made a difference to a child? I mean, I'm sure you made a difference to every child that you dealt with, but is there a special one?
Look, there was a few that, and they're the ones that keep you going too. So you sort of, I suppose you hold on to those ones. But one kid, when I first arrived at the Child Abuse Task Force, there was one young girl that it was a clear grooming case. It was just so classic grooming. We worked really well with Department of Children and Families, so the equivalent to DHS up there. We were able to get a protection order, so she was removed from the family, which sort of forced the mum's hand, I suppose. It was a friend of the mum's that was grooming this young girl, and sort of forced the mum to start thinking about protecting her own daughter. Anyway, as time went on, we got a full disclosure from this young girl, and it led to a lot of evidence that we gathered, and we were able to charge this guy with a heap of offences, and one of them was maintaining a sexual relationship with a child under 16. So that's it went to court, and he pleaded guilty, which was a good result.
VicPol, I've got to ask, what did you do to receive the honour, the huge honour of being named 3AW's Police Person of the Year?
I think back then it was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek. It's sort of evolved now, but look, it was just a sly that John Sylvester, who runs the award, he took a liking to one of my cases that I was handed when I went to cold case at homicide, and it was just an historical one from the 84, I think it was, and at the time, couldn't take it any further, but we got some new information and just landed on my desk. So, yeah, I investigated it. And it was actually an investigation into a murder where a husband was the victim, and he was slowly poisoned with arsenic from his loving wife over a two-year period in the early 80s. And then, we managed to get a conviction. She's serving a 22-year sentence.
You know, that's interesting you say that, because recently an investigation I did a podcast on, Operation Collier, was about a series of unsolved abductions and rapes, and I was explaining about how cases that are not solved or unsolved, they're never forgotten. Black Saturday, it was the 7th of February, 2009, and it was as if the whole of Victoria was burning, and really much of it was. A lot of the fires merged due to really high temperatures, never having been experienced in Victoria before. In fact, at one point, the temperature reached 46.4 in the Melbourne CBD. And the trouble was the high winds were changing direction and speed constantly, and that had catastrophic consequences. We had 173 lives lost, with over 400 suffering serious injuries. But then, of course, my passion, psychological injuries suffered have affected thousands. Then there's those who came to help in the bushfires, the volunteers, emergency services, government officials and reps, support services, and we could go on about them, you know, the Salvos, Red Cross, Rotary. It's such a long list, but it would have affected them also. They did find out, it was established that fallen power lines were the cause of the majority of fires, but there were a few arsonists also charged. I know my own experience of Black Saturday, it was so traumatic. It was a really, really dark day for Victorians. Beyond the human casualties of Black Saturday were the following stats. I won't go into too much other than to say there are over 7,500 people displaced, over 2,000 houses lost, We had machinery sheds by the hundreds, hay sheds by the hundreds, dairies, wool sheds, livestock, fodder, grain, like it just goes on and on, vines, olives, fruit trees, community buildings, fences. I think there's over 10,000 kilometres of fencing that were destroyed. And I don't know how you measure the psychological damage to not just those who were there, but to the thousands of others affected in their own way. Which brings me to you, the lovely Kira. Can you tell the listeners where you were stationed at the time of Black Saturday and being called up to assist? Basically, could you take us through your recollections of the day?
Yeah, so I was a detective sergeant at Diamond Creek Socket, so where I finished my career with VicPol, so the Sexual Offences and Child Abuse Investigation Team. So our unit was responsible for, you know, obviously the investigations of sexual assaults and child abuse matters, but during emergencies, we were tasked to coordinate any relief centres that were set up, and we also contributed to the roster for the fire patrols on total fire ban days. On that day, I actually wasn't on duty. I had already been rostered for an extra shift at the Moonee Valley races, of all things. So I don't know, that's why I ended up racing. But anyway, on that morning, Pete, my fellow sergeant at Socket, was working the morning shift in the op centre. And I remember I did speak to him a few times during the day. I mean, I was basically, like everyone else, locked in the house, just trying to get away from the heat and the wind and everything. And obviously I was conscious of, I lived in the area as well, so obviously I was conscious of that. And so I spoke to Pete a couple of times during the day, and it was all pretty calm. And but I remember just before he knocked off at 3, I remember him, when I last spoke to him, I said, you know, what's the go? And he said, oh, there's a big fire up out at Kilmore Way, but, you know, no, it's all good. But, you know, the wind changes, well, that's going to be an issue. We're pretty well staffed. So yeah, I was rostered on it just to start at 4, but I had to go to to Greensboro to pick up a car and then pick up a couple of members from there, and then we drove into Moonee Valley. So, and it was this one, I don't know, I just remember I didn't want to go. I just remember feeling like I needed to be, well, not only home because it was such a foul day, but I just felt that I needed to be in the, you know, your own patch sort of thing. I just didn't feel right, but I reluctantly went in, picked up the members, and we drove in. And not long into the shift, I remember overhearing someone talking about a big fire at Bendigo. And I thought, my parents aren't far from there. So I think I'd spoke to them during the day, but once I heard this, I think I rang again just to check. And Dad said, oh, yeah, there's been a really nasty fire at Bendigo. And I think by then they'd already confirmed that someone had lost their life there. And then he said, oh, there's one out at Whittlesea as well. So once I got off the phone to Dad, I actually just switched the radio, our police radio, onto channel 67. So that was our channel. You could just tell from the transmissions that all hell had broken loose. It was horrific what we were hearing. You know, obviously people or members coming up, urgent, that sort of thing. Oh, it was just, and you could hardly hear them. There was lots of broken transmissions and just panic, absolute panic.
And we know, don't we, that when the police radio, when somebody says urgent, that is, everyone stops in their tracks, don't they? It is an awful feeling when police on the radio, on the police radio, say urgent, because you know. That's very rare that happens, really.
Exactly. So, your heart sinks. Yeah. And because I was so far away as well, it wasn't as if I was in the patch. So I remember hearing the call sign for my members, so at Diamond Creek Socket, they're 463. I heard them come up at one stage, so I knew that they were there. It was quite a broken transmission. I could only get bits and pieces. And I really started to think, holy crap. And at that time, I just said to the guys we were working with, we've got to go. I just said we've got to go. And so we, the three of us, drove back to Greensboro. And all I can remember, we just sat in silence listening to the radio transmissions, just trying to sort out, you know, in our heads what was going on, and then switching between that and the ABC. I reckon it seemed like it took forever to get back to Greensboro, but I do remember trying to call Paul, my husband, because he's in the job as well. So he was working at Whittlesea that night. I started to think, holy crap, he's there as well. And, you know, 10,000 things go through your mind. But by the time I got back, I went to Don Creek. It was dark. So it must have been, I suppose it was daylight saving then, so it must have been after 9. But I do remember it was dark by the time I got back to Don Creek. And I just remember there was cars everywhere. There was cars parked in elite, you know, just all over the place. And I just remember seeing cars everywhere, but no one. I couldn't find anyone. It was just bizarre. But when I went in the back door of the station, the first thing I remember was that smell of smoke. Just, you know, you go to it, you might go camping and you sit around the campfire all night, and the next morning you just stink of smoke. But I couldn't find, there was no one around. It was just bizarre. And our office was upstairs, so it went up there, and I found Fozzie, and he was on the phone, and I could sort of, obviously I could hear his side of the conversation, and I then realised that he was on the phone to the coroner's court, or the morgue, and he was having a conversation about lodging some, what we call 83, so the forms that register a death. So he was trying to do that, and he was getting frustrated, and finally he got off the phone and he said, oh, they've told me not to bother. There's going to be a heap more. So, and he was obviously just distraught. I think he said, I don't know where Brooksy is. So I went for a walk and found her, and I didn't know what to say to Brooksy. And I just remember I just gave her a hug. I just, are you okay? And she was quite, just silent sort of thing. She couldn't speak, but I remember she had her vest on, her reflective vest, and it had singe marks all over it. She stunk of smoke, and I thought, what the hell have they been through? You know, I just thought. Yeah. So I tried to sort of talk to them and find out what was going on, and they were just exhausted. And obviously, they'd come across a guy that had an accident on a motorbike, so that was who Fozzie was trying to register as deceased. Mm-hmm. And basically right at when the fire front hit. And then I finally heard the boss of Diamond Creek, not our unit but of Uniform, who's an absolute legend. I heard Spencey's voice, and so I've gone in there, and they're in the ops centre, and there was a couple of bosses there. And actually, I actually remember, all I can remember thinking was, they need a cup of tea. How stupid's that? Would you like a cup of tea? I think I asked him about 20,000 times, would you like a cup of tea? As you do.
Can you just help the listeners? What's the op centre that you talk about?
Okay, so each division on a total fire ban day will set up an op centre, and they liaise with the CFA. And so, yeah, I found them in the op centre, which is just a room off the kitchen, hence why I kept asking for a cup of tea. Spence, he'd been working the whole time, so. But yeah, he was still coordinating, and everything was calm. And he said, "Oh, look, can you do me one favour? Can you come down to the relief centre down at Diamond Creek, which had been set up? I just need to check in on them." And given that that's our portfolio, I thought, "Oh, yeah, well, absolutely." So we went, and there actually wasn't any members at the centre at the time. Obviously, we were a bit short on resources, so it had just sort of been set up. I remember going downstairs to try and find some keys. I mean, the station, which is usually pretty schmicko because Spencey runs it, but there was stuff. Obviously, there was stuff everywhere. There was
chaos.
I couldn't find the car keys, and so I'm hunting around in the watch house trying to find the car keys. And I look up and I see some headlights in the CCTV camera, and it was a big truck, and I was like, oh. And he was backing up, and I could hear the reverse lights on, and then press the buzzer to be let in. And so I put the intercom on. I couldn't hear him, so I went outside and he said, "Oh, mad love, I've just got the truck that, you know, Spencey's ordered. Where do you want me to put it?" And I'm like, "Oh, okay, well," so I opened the gate and just, and then he got out and he started telling me how to turn the fridge on. It's a refrigerated truck. I'm thinking, what the hell do we need a truck for? You know, it was just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought, oh, yeah, all right. So I've gone back inside and I said, so Spencey, and he goes, "Oh, yeah, that's, yeah, we've got that because we're going to need it." I said, "Oh, what, how much food are we?" I know, I was thinking, what for? And then, of course, it dawned on me, it's for the bodies. Just unreal. And there was already a deceased person in at the CFA next door who'd had a heart attack. So that was basically the start of, I suppose, realisation for me that this is just, you know, massive. Anyway, so Spencey and I went down to the relief centre, and even before we got to the entrance, we were wearing uniform, we were just mobbed by people desperate for information, and obviously we didn't have much information. But so we eventually returned to the station. It was probably about 3 a.m. by that time, and started to get rosters going to man the relief centres and the next day to start getting some search teams together. I did duck home. I had to duck home. I had a shower. I was still so hot, and I also had to check on my dogs because it was so hot. So Paul arrived.
What about
home.
Paul? Oh,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So he arrived home as I was heading out back up to work. And it was then that I found out that the reason why he wasn't answering his phone, obviously he was flat chat because he was the only unit in the area that was basically responding to normal jobs. Everyone else had been taken up to Whittlesea and up the mountain. So he was running around like a headless chook trying to respond to jobs. And then some idiot decided to punch on with him, and they all ended up in a barbed wire fence. So he ended up at the Northern Hospital. They all needed to get tetanus jabs. And yeah, so he was exhausted. But anyway, I didn't see him for another 5 days.
So
yeah.
you've been working since 4 o'clock on the Sunday or the Saturday? The Saturday.
It was a Saturday, yeah.
Right. You've been working since 4. You've got home at 3 to have a quick shower, no sleep, touch base with Paul, and you're back.
And obviously I had to deal with the relief centre because that was our main responsibility. Mm-hmm. So, and, yeah, all our members didn't hesitate to come in. Even Fozzie and Brooksy came in. They were probably the first ones there. And I'm thinking, oh, God, do they really need to? Fozzie was just adamant. He wanted to be a part of the scratch crews that we were forming to go and search. And he kept saying, well, I've been up there. I know exactly where people are, that sort of thing. So
did you feel conflicted in a way because you've got members, I suppose you've got to think of their welfare, but it sounds like Foz and Brooksy are just like me. I don't know what it is with policing, but I remember I rang our inspector and I pleaded with him, I want to go, I want to help, I don't care what you tell me to do, I'll do. I don't know what it is that draws you. It's just so confronting and so shocking and everything. I don't know what it is that makes you want to be there, you know, and help.
I suppose that's why we all joined the job though, isn't it, really? So I was with the search team and Pete and Foz and I were one team, and I think there was about probably 6 other teams made up of uniform and plainclothes people just from the area sort of thing. So they were just basically scratch crews. And we were basically just tasked to go and I suppose canvas property by property as to, you know, if there were survivors or anyone that needed first aid, that sort of thing, and reporting. So we were in uniform. It was just normal uniform. At that stage, we didn't have any overalls or anything like that. So we just went out in our uniform, just took out our you know, our OST equipment, so our firearm and OC spray and your baton, just your normal sort of equipment. Mm-hmm. The cars always had first aid kits and fire kits in them, particularly because we were in that fire-prone area. So we made sure that the fire kits were, and they, you know, they'll have a blanket and goggles, that sort of thing, a couple of masks. So I remember seeing actually all the fire kits had been sort of opened up, and so we had to replenish them with what we could. And I also remember searching around in the boot for a roll of crime scene tape. So you go, oh, yeah, we've got half a roll here. Let's chuck that in as well, you know. Not expecting to be, using it like we did. But anyway, we did. I also remember grabbing, I had a bit of a stash of muesli bars and stuff in my desk. So I grabbed some of those. And I think we grabbed some chips from the little snack thingy at the station and took a couple of bottles of water and off we went. So the three of us, we're in a sedan, I think, but the three of us were obviously all from the same office, so we knew each other, and Pete and Foz have been mates for a very long time, and obviously we're all, you know, good mates. But I think from that time on, that was, we're more than good mates now because of what we experienced from that time onwards, I suppose. So I just remember seeing green grass and thinking, there's green grass. And then all of a sudden it was like there had been a straight line drawn down the paddock. It was green grass and then everything was black. That contrast was, it was unreal. And then all of a sudden I started seeing dead cows and horses lying in paddocks, and just everything was just black.
How were you feeling at that point?
I was still in a bit of shock, but from what Fozzie had described to us, I suppose I was expecting animals because of the fire front, the way it came through, but I don't think I expected to see many bodies. I was sort of hoping that people got out. And I remember the first property we came to, it was like walking on Mars. It was just, I've never been to Mars, but I'm only assuming it was like, I likened it to Mars of what you see on documentaries and stuff, that it was just, just the no sound was just, the only sound you would get would be a falling tree, and that would echo. It was just nothing. It was just, everything was burnt, and And then we actually went into one property that had been fully destroyed, and then over the hill we saw this four-wheel drive coming towards us. So they were the first people we actually saw. It was a carload of about five or six people in this four-wheel drive. They wound down the window. I don't think they got out. They wound down the window, and all their faces were black, and the eyes were really red, and they're obviously okay, but all they wanted from us, we need our horses. We're really worried about our horses. They're in pain. They need to be destroyed. Can you help us? And I mean, we couldn't, because we only had our 38 revolvers. They're not powerful enough to kill a horse. And we only had six bullets, 18 bullets between us. So, and I'm not a very good shot. And we said, oh, look, we'll see what we can do, try and get someone from, someone to come down and destroy them. And I just remember feeling, how can we just leave them? And we had to. Took down their names, because we were obviously taking down anyone that we found sort of. I remember I gave them a bottle of water and that was it. We left. I thought, what the hell? What?
What happened? What was that? Yeah.
We didn't even hear how they survived or any. I think they actually, I don't even know their names now to this day, but I think they survived by jumping in the pool. They never came across them again, and I never got the chance to say, look, I'm sorry. Hopefully someone was able to destroy their horses pretty soon. But and then the next human contact we had was when we went to a house that was still standing in Arthur's Creek. So we're sort of doing a door-to-door, and the family there came out to greet us and let us know that they'd actually called 000 not long before we arrived, because their neighbour's 18-year-old son had he'd arrived and feared that his parents were still in the house, which had been destroyed, because they'd been up to the driveway, but saw the house had been destroyed, and there was also some CFA tape across the driveway. So they came back, and that's when they called 000. So we went up there, and sure enough, there was CFA tape across the driveway, and the house had been fully destroyed, and garage and so forth. And then Pete, I heard Pete yell out, "Oh, they're in here, I found them down here. We've gone down there." And I went down some steps into what looked like a cellar and saw a man and a woman. They were lying together and they were holding hands. So I've already started, Ariel. So this is, I think, just the fact, I suppose they were the first people we came across too, but the fact that they were holding hands, it was lovely that they could be together, I suppose. And then they were cradling their little dog. But they weren't burnt. They were fully identifiable. So I think
we'd get through this. Oh my goodness. Just the thought of seeing them holding hands. Oh, yeah. And their little dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was a small pile of vomit next to the dog's mouth. I remember thinking, and that's when I thought, we all thought they're suffocated because they weren't burnt. So, yeah, we added a small piece of crime scene tape that I had in the boot. We just added that to the CFA tape just as a sign that, you know, this is crime scene effectively.
When you found them and they're obviously deceased, so do you do anything crime scene-wise? Like, what was your role in that?
Yeah, so we couldn't do the normal sort of procedure where you have to remain at the property. We were just told that we needed to mark it as a crime scene and notify comms of the address, and obviously note down the address and any, you know, if we were able to say who we thought it was. So we had that information from the son.
Was the son there with you?
So he stayed, the people at the neighbour's house, they were just so lovely. They took care of him, and I mean they obviously knew what had happened, that they've had this, you know, 18-year-old kid rock up the house and just distraught. So they've taken care of him, and that's when they rung 000, and then we went down and confirmed it and then came back. And yeah, they just, yeah, we just went in, they showed us into the house, and obviously the neighbours knew what it was going to be. But I think their son was hoping that it wasn't or whatever, but he was obviously in shock. So, yeah, we went into the lounge room, and I remember I was kneeling down. He was on the couch and I was sort of kneeling down. And this is just bizarre, how selfish is this? But I can remember my knees were screaming because I was bending down. You know how you just, I was trying to, yeah, give him the news, and my knees are screaming, and he wasn't saying too much, and he's obviously in shock, and I said to him that we think that they've suffocated, and he was asking a few little questions, but nothing, you know, sort of.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he piped up and he said, "What about our dog? Did you find the dog?" And I lost it immediately. You hear that feeling in your throat where you think, oh, my God, my throat. You're just trying to stop yourself from choking. I got that. So I had the screaming knees, the screaming throat, and then I just let the tears roll down my face, and I said, "Yes, we found the dog, and it's in between your mum and dad." And he was sort of relieved that I didn't want to obviously cry, but I just couldn't help it.
But how could you not cry or be affected by something really, in a way, so shocking but so beautiful, like so sad? It's a bit of everything, you know. How could you not? Isn't it funny how police put up this facade? Like, and I suppose we do have to be strong to a point, but you probably showed the human side of policing that day to that young man.
Well, I came up on the radio, and I'm pretty sure, actually, I haven't asked Pete or Foz this, they probably wouldn't remember, but I'm pretty sure I actually said, "Yes, we've located two deceased persons and a dog." I'm pretty sure I said that. I think they may have told us that the auntie was at the Arthur's Creek Relief Centre. Well, it might have come from the neighbours, I'm not sure. So we went up there and found her. But I remember stepping out of the car and everyone was, it was like everyone was hoping that we weren't looking for them, sort of thing. So, yeah, Pete gave the news to the auntie. And but then, yeah, again, we had to go. We couldn't spend too much time and had to keep going. So we then worked our way into Strathion itself. And then so that was the next contact we had with someone, and that was with the local CFA captain. And there was also a bulldozer driver there who was trying to clear a track. So we were on Chad's Creek Road, near the oval, where we came across just a white Ford that was still intact, hadn't been burnt. And then we saw a body lying in the grass parking area near the oval, not far from the car, probably about 300 metres from the car. And that's where we came across the CFA captain, and oh, he was in an absolute, as you could imagine, he was in an absolute state. But he knew the chap on the oval and said, oh, it's Peter Ebola. And he wanted to move Peter, the chap on the oval, from where he was. He was just lying out on the oval sort of thing, or in this sort of grassed area in the open sort of thing. And the CFA captain, David, just wanted to move him. And I had a really hard time explaining to him that we needed to leave him, you know, there because it's a crime scene, that sort of thing. And
I understand that, because you don't want to leave them just out there in the elements. You want to, it sounds silly, doesn't it, but you want to make them comfortable. You want to put a rug around them. You want to.
He'd just been through absolute hell. So he lost half of his town and he knew everyone. He was the local CFA fire captain. So they're all looking to him sort of thing. So, yeah, it was just, we were trying to work out how it happened, you know, why had Peter ended up on the oval and why his car wasn't burnt. And we learnt later on that his wife had, I think David might have told us that day that he'd been driving out in a separate car from his wife, and she'd been driving behind him, but he failed to take a bend and suddenly stopped. So he waved her on, and then obviously got stuck and got out of the car. And so I just seeing him on his own there was just really. And then I thought, oh God, his poor wife who's seen him, and you know she's been waited on, and so we just didn't want to leave him there on his own. It just didn't feel right. So Fozzie reminded me that we actually ripped up some of the cricket pitch from the oval and tried to cover him and sort of put it somewhere so we could put some crime scene tape as well to try and contain it.
Yeah.
So, but then again, we just had to keep going, so we had to leave him. And
God, to leave him, it reminds me of Anna Sharp at the tip when everyone was leaving Anna because we had to wait for crimes. I couldn't leave her, and even though she was very deceased, I get that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you to the following patrons: Allison, Ginny Hall, Jody Deeth, Laura Bray, Amy O, and Mark Ofmalovia. Emily and I are currently producing a regular video series for our patrons in which we recommend true crime documentaries, books, podcasts, and whatever else we can think of that is entertaining in isolation. My pick for this week, by the way, is the brand new podcast that we foreshadowed some months ago. It's called Who Killed Leanne Holland? We'll have an interview with the producer of that podcast for our patrons in coming weeks. He's also the man behind Beenham Valley Road. You've heard from him before, Jamie Pultz. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/osttruecrime.
Hey, Kiri, you know that last break we had.
Is it going okay?
Oh, yeah. Exactly what I wanted. But I go and have a break. You know, it's been a bit tough, isn't it? Like, it's hard, right? Anyway, I go out and Lloyd's had the solar power bloke to come round, and he's telling me all about how the solar fucking panels are going to work. I mean, really? You know, and how they're not going to be going into the SEC. They're not, you know, they're going to be, I felt like saying, Lloyd, you know, I've just been talking about, you know, deceased people in a house, and he's,
oh, bless him.
God love him.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be okay about the couple, but I clearly wasn't. But anyway.
But how could you not be? How could you be okay telling a story like that? I just think it shows that, you know, we're human like anyone else, and it's pretty tough. And, you know, when you consider this is the first time that you've ever told this story. Is that true? Or?
I've told snippets of it. Those two incidents I spoke about, they're probably the hardest.
So where were we? Well, we were with Pete on the oval, and you'd covered him with some grass, and it was about leaving him and how difficult it was to leave him, but you sort of acted. It's funny how when they're deceased but you still want them to be comfortable.
I think it must have been like a carpet sort of cricket pitch. So somehow we managed to rip it up and, just another one that we had to leave. And I think the couple from Arthur's Creek and Peter from the Oval, I suppose, because all of them were identifiable. So I think that's why they stick in my mind, or whether they were because they were the first people that we did come across, I'm not sure. But I think just the image with the couple in Arthur's Creek, the image of them holding their hand, you know, holding each other's hands. And then with Peter, just insist on his own. And, so I think that's why those two in particular, those three, stick in my mind. Yeah, we had to leave the Oval and then...
I cannot imagine leaving them, Kira. What must you have felt like to leave Peter there on his own? Doesn't bear thinking about.
I think the only solace we got from it was we ran into Coxie, a guy I used to work with, but he's at crime scene now. He was in the area. So I think he got there to process, you know, the complete process the scene. I think he got there, certainly got there that day. So that was some solace, I suppose. But, just have to, I suppose, plough on.
You know, it reminds me... On Black Saturday, when you were talking about the couple's son and they'd passed away, I was in a relief centre like you were at Alexandra, and I had an opposite story in that I'll never forget a little old man that I saw. He'd lost everything and he was in the fetal position, and he was in the corner of this huge basketball stadium. You know how that's what the relief centres were? They were just basketball stadiums and everyone had their little area, and there's dogs and cats and everything. And I'll never forget seeing this little old man, and he was rocking sort of back and forth, and all he had was this, it was like a blanket that he was lying on, and he was so alone. But he was alive, but so alone and just so frightened. He would have had to have been 90. And I remember a couple came up to the table where we were looking for their loved ones and people that had passed away. And you know how you've got that, what's your name, who are you looking for, and all that sort of stuff. Mm. And I remember this middle-aged couple came up to the table and said, oh, we're looking for I'm looking for my dad. They were so distraught. And I'm looking, you know, we're looking for our dad. And they said, oh, you know, he's elderly. And anyway, I don't know why, but I thought, I bet you it's that little man, you know. Anyway, I remember taking them over and they just like collapsed because I said, I think I know where your dad is. I took them over and they sort of collapsed with him. And it must have been the wife and husband. And what they did was they laid each side of this little old man. Oh, my God. I'll never forget it. And they were just so, they were stroking him and, you know, oh, you're alive. It was, and like he was alive. So, and that's something that stayed with me. I've never, ever forgotten that. All the police that had anything to do with Black Saturday, we've all got, you know, stories like that. But it just reminded me of them when you say about the couple holding hands. This was the opposite. They were alive, but it was still so traumatic.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it was a trigger. I don't know what you call it. But I really lost it after that. I had to leave the relief centre. I had to walk outside and just go and get some fresh air. And I bawled my eyes out. I reckon I was so distraught over that because it reminded me of a little old man that I'd seen, and I've told this on the podcast before, about one of the most terrible things I ever saw in policing was when we found a little old man deceased in a flat. He just died of natural causes, but he was in exactly the same, he was lying in the same position as the old man in the relief centre. He only had a bookcase. He was lying on a soiled mattress. He didn't have any blankets or anything. And he had a half a bottle of scotch. And the detective took it and put it under his coat and walked out. He pinched it. So I think seeing that little old man alive took me right back to that, because I've never forgotten that. I thought that was one of the most terrible, terrible things I've ever seen in my career. Mm. But anyway, we digress, my friend. So how did you and the boys deal with that this particular day? Like when you got back in the car, like what was the conversation? Was it quiet? Was it, you know, like, my God?
Yeah, I think the first day, I think it was quiet. By the second day, I suppose you adapt and, you know, you started having a few little jokes around each other, you know, that what they call black humour, that sort of thing, that came out.
You've got to have something to get you through, and if it's having a bit of a laugh and, you know, humour, it is terrible some of the things you laugh about, but.
Yeah, and I think the first day it just couldn't even use that. Usually we're pretty good at, you know, straight away, but, yeah, that day we just couldn't. And I think we just had to keep going, and I suppose we were running on adrenaline, and we soon realised that we were no longer looking for survivors. There's no way anyone could survive what we were seeing. So we were just, you know, house after house, and there was cars hooked up with trailers and pet cages, you know, ready to go. You could obviously see that they were ready to go but hadn't made it. Some remains you could make out that they were actually, whether they were an adult or a child, or while others, yeah, we started just finding bones and teeth. It was yeah, sifting through rubble, we soon figured out that, yeah, that the best place to look was actually if you could work out where the plumbing was in the house, you could sort of start, it was a good starting point, because we were finding that a lot of the people, the remains we were finding were either in the bathroom or the kitchen sort of area. So that was in Strathewen. So we went to, started going through there, and then we all sort of met up with the other search teams, and it seemed to be, it was late afternoon, I think, that we were sort of all, you know, swapping lists. So we're, you know, ticking off where we'd been and where they'd been and what we thought, you know, who we'd found, or, you know, there was, oh, I think there was a couple of people in here and rah, rah, rah. And I think, look, I can't be exact, but I think it was up to about 20 by that time, just in that area. But we were near the school, the Strathewen, which had been destroyed, and Strathewen is, it's very dense forest sort of thing. It's a, but all the trees had obviously gone, and all of a sudden we all seemed, at the one time, it was bizarre, we all seemed to get a mobile phone signal, because usually you wouldn't get a signal up there. All our phones started beeping. I remember looking around and everyone was on their phones, whether they were retrieving messages or whatever, and so I had a couple of messages, and I think, you know, just, oh, how you going, Mara? But, yeah, so I tried to ring Paul and nothing, it went to voicemail. I don't know, I started to panic. I think it all just got too much.
And all got too much.
Even though I happened to him that morning, but because I tried calling him and I couldn't get through, I was stressing about that. So after a while they did establish that Paul was okay, but by this time the whole of extended family, which is extensive, they all thought that Paul was missing. Oh, God, it was a bit of a... And then I think Lauren had tried to call police headquarters. Oh, it was just, yeah, anyway.
I've got sisters too. So, I get it.
So we all had our phone calls and then all got back to it. And
so what are the boys like? Who are the boys talking to? Like, were they losing it, or were they sort of, or were they trying to control themselves, or were they, had that facade that so many policemen have, you know, I've got to be strong?
Yeah, I don't remember them seeing them visibly upset. But
you were making up for the two of them, obviously. Oh,
clearly, yeah. and Pete, I mean, you know Pete, but you know what he's like, and it was just, oh, yeah, I've just rung the missus and, you know, all right, yeah, told her how fucked it is.
Everything's great.
Yeah, yep. So we eventually, that day, yeah, I think we got up to about 20, and by the time it was, I mean, we hadn't eaten or anything, so I think we headed back back to the station. I remember actually being, when we arrived back at the station, we didn't know anyone that was there. I'm like, who are these people? You know, why are they here? They're in it. This is our station. Yeah. It's funny how you get a bit protective, or I don't know. Yeah. It was just, but there was people everywhere. There was just, and compared to the night before where there was no one, I couldn't find anyone. It was just a really bizarre sort of.
How long had you been working by that point when you get back to the station and you, there's all these strange people? What sort of hours had you been working?
Oh, it was probably, I reckon I was at the station at 5 in the morning, 5:30, and then this would have been 6, 7 by the time we got back.
But what you've really done is you started at 4 o'clock on the Saturday and you've gone home for a shower at 3 a.m. the following day, and then you're working till 5 a.m. the following morning, yeah?
Oh, so I had that... when I got home to have a shower, there was a couple of hours. Well, you know, I had a shower.
Oh, right. And then, that'd and be then a good rest back. Too.
Yeah.
That'd be a good rest. Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and then, yeah, so we were just running on empty at the stage. And it's funny how I can remember getting, a bit antsy about all these police that we didn't know, you know, how dare they, and come on our patch. I mean, they're only helping. It was just ridiculous. There was people telling bosses to get, you know, effed, and it was just
everyone's patience had just, you know, well, you didn't have any.
I can remember I had a hissy fit because I went upstairs to the intel office who were coordinating, you know, what we, our lists as such, and because they were having Red Cross send through the missing persons list and updating it regularly. So we had a big whiteboard and trying to figure out, you know, who was missing, who we perhaps located, that sort of thing. So I handed in my list, and I remember the guy just put it in a tray. He just chucked it in a tray. And I'm like, yeah. No, you need to start looking at this now, you know. Oh, the poor guy. Yeah. He probably, yeah, I just went off. And we did have a beer that night, which is bizarre, but I remember it was very warm beer. I don't know where we got it from. Yeah, Fozzie Pete and I sat in the car park and had a beer. And then I did manage to speak to Paul briefly on the phone, but he was at a roadblock at that stage and he couldn't talk. So, that yeah, went home that night. Obviously, I don't think I slept, but, you know, you try.
No.
Next day we reassembled and the same teams headed back up the mountain, and we wanted to keep the same teams because by that stage you knew what, you know, what you were looking for, that sort of thing, not like the plumbing, that sort of thing, and you, obviously, you know, working with mates and stuff like that. So yeah, that day we started up at we're concentrated on Bald Spur Road, which you mentioned in your intro. So that starts up down in St Andrews and then goes right up to King Lake Central. So that becomes another someone else's patch, but it's sort of crossed over with our patch. So we concentrated on Bald Spur Road, but up the top end rather, because St Andrews the day before we'd already found a couple of deceased persons in that end. So we started up the other end, and the first house where we thought we had human remains was, and it's funny, I remember the numbers of the houses, names weren't, we didn't know the names of the families then, but yeah, I just knew them by numbers. So I remember at number 15 we had we found three deceased, what we thought was three deceased persons. Again, they were pretty much bones, that sort of thing. And they appeared to be in the bathroom, but we'd heard that there was an 8-month-old there, but we only found what we thought was three human remains, which was a family of four. So and even then, Fozzie reminded me the other day when we were talking, a bloke from crime scene came running up and going crazy, get out of my crime scene, that sort of, it was just bizarre.
God.
You know, these are, yeah, just,
yeah.
Oh, you know, it's not your crime scene. Anyway, we moved on. I can remember at number 29, there was a family of three, and at number 39, there was a family of five, and then a couple of
And are these deceased 50, persons that you saw? Were these deceased? You found a family?
Yeah. Found a family of five. So by the time we finished, or hadn't finished Bald Spur Road, but as we were getting in, that was just the numbers were just growing. And looking at it, you just thought there's no way you could survive. It was just, it was unreal. And it was actually some years later, I was actually doing a DVI course, a disaster victim identification course, when I was with NT Police, and they used Black Saturday as a case study. And they had some Victorian coppers presenting, which... Yeah, it was interesting. It just brought up quite a few memories because they concentrated on the case study. They actually concentrated on the DVI process, and that's obviously getting your two forms of ID, so your dental or DNA or, you know, that sort of thing. But they found the family at number 15, where we found three, that was actually four, they left. That was the very last family to be identified out of the whole 173 people, because there was nothing left of the 8-month-old, because there's no teeth or
so
they basically had to rely on circumstantial process of elimination. Sort of brought back a few memories. I knew exactly who they were talking about as soon as they started talking. So that's number 15. Bald Spur Road was just stands out as the worst of the worst, I suppose. I mean, and there was obviously plenty of others, but I think because it was so concentrated and we were going from door to door, that's, it sort of had a
massive impact on us. But
did you find anyone alive?
Funny you should say that, Narelle. So we, at the top, at the ridge on the King Lake Central end, we were told that there's a house on the top of the ridge, full drive, yeah, and the owner, Wendy, she, who was a CFA member, that she would be there. So that was the final house that we got to, and I thought, how the hell, there's no way she would survive that. So we, sure enough, we found the car that was totally destroyed. There was blobs of melted metal everywhere, all over the, you know, and that was, we're seeing that quite regularly, but just the, yeah, everything had just been, I thought, how the hell would you survive that? And then there was a dead wallaby, and just outside the front, or the, what we feared was a doorway. It was a mud brick house, so you could sort of make out the doorway, but there was this dead wallaby there. It was bizarre. Mm-hmm. And the yard was right on the roadside sort of thing. The house was not far from the roadside. And so we were searching all around the yard, and then something caught my eye. I'm not sure if it was someone else saw it first, or but we saw something that caught our eye. It was a bright red thing. Went over and had a look at it, and it was actually a red dolphin torch, but it had melted into the roadway. So it was still intact, but the bottom of it had melted, the bit with a globe that was pointing up. So
yep,
the base of the torch had melted into the roadway. And we sort of thought, that's a bit weird, because it stood out because it was bright red, and it just seemed a little bit odd. But anyway, we just thought, okay, I actually just took a picture of it. I'll take a picture of it. And then we kept going. And then when we were inside, there was a fridge had fallen down, and there seemed to be something underneath it. So we lifted it up and found some really long bones that similar to a femur, so your thigh bone. That's what it seemed like.
Oh dear.
And we thought, I think by that time you're just so exhausted. We convinced each other that they were human bones. And then we're thinking, oh, holy crap, this person's tried to climb into the fridge, take refuge from the fire in there. And it all made sense to us at the time. And so we put the crime scene up, you know, tape up, added it to the tally, and then another crew rocked up. And, well, I mean, we were obviously delirious by this stage. We convinced them that this lady had got in the fridge and, oh, God, everyone. So by the time we got back down the mountain, everyone in the area had heard about this diamond, this woman that had perished in the fridge.
So, Wendy.
Yeah. Hmm. So she was on the list that we were keeping. So a few days later, I got a call from one of the girls from our office that was at the relief centre, and she was excited. I was so excited. She said, "You'll never believe who I've just met." I thought she met a celebrity or something. And I was like, "Oh, who?" She said, "You'll never believe it. The fridge lady, she's alive." And I've gone, "No way."
The fridge lady. So,
yeah, the fridge lady.
Yeah.
Carrie quickly explained that when he had been rescued by a friend and been taken to the Austin, she'd been put in the back of a police car at King Lake and driven down, because there was no ambulances going up, so she'd been driven down to Whittlesea and then ferried down into the Austin. And when she'd been released from hospital, she turned up at the release centre at Diamond Creek to register that she was safe, and Carrie happened to be the person that was sitting next to the Red Cross desk.
Yeah, yeah.
And so she's relayed the story. "We thought you were dead," and rah, rah, and
under the fridge.
Told her the story, and they were dog bones. She had two dogs that were safe at the King Lake CFA, but she kept big bones, but they were big dogs, kept big bones for them to have a bit of a chew on. They were the dog bones, so not of the dog, but of the trip.
Yeah. When you were up there, you would never in your wildest dreams think of their bones for a dog, you know. Like, you would assume that poor Wendy was in the fridge. Well, I get all that you sort of try and put two and two together to make sense of it, but sometimes it just doesn't make sense, does it?
No. And when you look back, you think, oh, that was stupid. But anyway, but it's funny how we all convinced each other, and I suddenly became an expert in bones. I mean, anyway.
Not.
Pete and I actually caught up with Wendy. She became a bit of a rural myth, and
we actually were able to catch up with her. Kerry organised it. So I still couldn't believe that she was alive. And I was actually obviously a great moment to catch up with her. I think I hugged her, you know, offered her a cup of tea. But she told us, she then went into the story of how she survived. It is unbelievable. But, she basically, she was working at the CFA and went back home. You know, she was fully kitted out and started dousing her house with water and stuff because there was embers coming and that sort of thing up the ridge. And then it just all exploded, and she dropped the hose and ran into the wallaby as she headed inside the house. So that's where the wallaby comes into it. And then the house was just exploding around her, and she crawled into the alcove of the chimney, really struggled to breathe, obviously, but
God,
that she actually, yeah, got through it and realised that the worst of the fire had passed. So she crawled outside and through onto the roadway, and she was really struggling to breathe. So she had really bad smoke inhalation, and she put her red dolphin torch down and sat on it, and that's what melted in, and it actually burnt her bum because it was so hot. But that's what actually was what we found. And then she tried walking the 4 kilometres back up to the main road, but she kept passing out and just lay on the road.
Burnt bum and everything she's
been through. Yeah, smoke inhalation. Yeah, she was very unwell. Yeah, so she lay on the road in the recovery position, but then she realised that her mobile phone was in her pocket. And like the phone signal that we got in Strathuil, and all of a sudden had a phone signal, which is virtually non-existent when prior to. And then, she managed to make a call to her friend, who I think was in East Gippsland, who happened to answer the call. And I'm not quite, can't quite remember how it all happened. But then her friend, Lorraine, who was down at Kinglake CFA, managed to get through. There was trees down everywhere on that road, everything. So I think she walked the last couple of K, basically carried her out into the car, and then drove her back down to Kinglake. And then,
incredible.
So it was sort of a story that we clung on to. And
now you've also got a beautiful story about the blanket.
Yes.
Can you tell the listeners about the blanket?
Yes. Where do I start? So when I got home after the first day of searching, so that Sunday, I spoke to my mum and dad briefly and let them know that Paul was okay and not missing as expected and rah-rah. But I don't think I said much to mum and dad that night. I was pretty well shattered. But I don't know much about the conversation, but Lauren does. She remembers every word. She's told me.
While you're on that, Lauren is your sister, eldest sister.
So there's Lauren, Sandy, then me. So she's... on the baby. She reminded me recently that I don't remember any of this, so obviously it's all a bit of a blur, but she told me that I was sobbing my heart out and it was hard to make sense of what I was saying. But she recalls that I told her about the couple in the cellar that I've spoken about and their dog. And then she says I was frantically and at times I was quite hysterical, insisting that she leaves in any fire because she lives in the Macedon Ranges, so she's in a fire-prone area. Apparently I was just insistent that she leaves. So after telling her a couple of the things I'd seen, and obviously the couple in the cellar and that sort of thing, she was talking to her, she had a friend in WA, and I think she rang Lauren to see what she could do, and Lauren saying, oh, there's nothing. But she said, I've just spoken to my sister and told her friend Jen about, you know, what the phone call I had with her, and that she felt really helpless about not being able to, you know, be a big sister for me, and was quite distraught. So Jen and Lauren had a common interest, though, in sewing quilts. So Jen would often... So when her disabled adopted son was having a bad night with seizures, so Jen suggested to Lauren that she start on a quilt to give me, and Lauren thought that was a great idea. And so a few weeks later, after the search has been finished and the relief centres were sort of winding down, or you know, I can remember it was really hard going back to, you know, normal life. I just, everyone was struggling with it. And I, and when many of us were going to the funerals or memorial services to the local people that we'd come across. But because it was such a drawn-out process, because so many of the remains couldn't be identified easily, so there was a lot of memorial services and then funerals later on. And but the first funeral I did go to was for the couple at Arthur's Creek. That's Joseph and Glenys, because they were probably one of the first to be identified, because they were identifiable, so they could actually have a proper funeral for them. So Fozzie and I went to the funeral, and which was, yeah, I was glad we went, but obviously it was pretty distressing, but for everyone. Oh. But yeah, pretty distraught that day. But that afternoon I got a card to collect a parcel from the post office, and I wasn't expecting any parcels, but it was addressed to me, so I thought, oh, maybe it's something I've ordered on eBay or something. Or yeah, so I went up and got the parcel, and I didn't recognise the sender's details. I just so I checked that it was addressed to me, and it definitely was my name. So I took it, and I was quite intrigued. So I waited. I didn't wait until I got home. I just sat in the car and opened it up, and a letter fell out of this parcel. And I opened it up a bit more, and I could see that there was this beautiful handmade quilt. And actually, since you asked me to do this podcast, I actually have searched everywhere for this letter, but because I know I did keep it, but I can't find it. So I'll probably find it tonight once we've finished. But
yeah,
I can still remember what it said, and it was obviously from Jen, Lauren's friend from WA. She wrote that after hearing what Lauren had told her about what we were seeing with my colleagues, and she wanted to make this quilt for me to show, you know, her appreciation for the work that we were doing and for some comfort for me when I was having a bad day, and that sort of, yeah, that was the theme of the letter. So I sat in the car for eight. I was just sobbing. I was just,
such, yeah, a beautiful random act of kindness.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was just completely overwhelmed with how a complete stranger could show such an appreciation for and an understanding of what we were going through. It was just, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and the quilt was, oh, it was just beautiful. It was, you know, I think the nicest thing that anyone's ever done.
Yeah.
I've still got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful. And did you ever speak to Jen or the lady that made the quilt?
No, I actually I did write
that'd
a letter. I just wanted her to know how much it was appreciated that she could appreciate. Yeah, but I've still got the quilt, and I've got it on the spare bed. So yeah, I look at it every day.
That's beautiful. In fact, I think I've slept under that quilt, haven't I? I'm sure that when I came up to when I came up to NT to see you, I think I slept under that quilt. Oh, it's just such a beautiful quilt.
So yeah, it's just, but I mean, that we were just a tiny, tiny part of that, you know, that whole horrible set of circumstances, but then so many people would have so many stories or recollections of that they've endured, and yeah, it's just there's so many things that even just talking to Pete and Fozzie recently that we can, you know, oh, that's right, yeah, and yeah, yeah. Imagine how many stories there are out there about Black Saturday or, you know, anything that's such like a traumatic event like that. It's just
the number of police that attended those fires, they would all have stories, you know, sad stories and beautiful stories, like, you know, the quilt. You said before that you've spoken to your sisters and your mum, your poor mum, putting her through that. I suppose you have spoken to a lot of members knowing that today was coming up to help research-wise and to, you know, help you remember, because obviously in times of stress you forget a lot of things. But they were the ones who you called when you were so distraught. And I suppose we find out, don't we, that there is a ripple effect for everyone involved in these sort of things. And the ripple effect had a huge effect on your family.
Yep.
it wasn't until recently when I spoke to Lauren about doing this podcast that that's obviously when I learned about that phone call that I mean, I knew I spoke to her, but I had no idea that how much it had affected her. She was trying to be that support for me, but, yeah, it just felt so, I suppose, useless. I mean, she's always been my big sister, so, you know, she's always wanted to be protecting me, and she saw a lot of trauma herself in the aftermath because she was helping out with the animal aid in King Lake, so she saw a lot of terrible things up there as well. So, yeah, I just didn't realise how much my experience had affected her, and she spoke to me about, she has one vivid memory of when she was in King Lake on that Wednesday, so a couple of days later. And I was in Strathewen still, but we couldn't meet up. I mean, they're a stone's throw away, really, but we just couldn't meet up. You know, we're texting each other, but she was obvious. And there's roadblocks and all that sort of thing that you had to deal with. But she says that's where she's never felt so useless. We hadn't seen each other. We'd only spoken to each other on the phone. She just wanted to give me a hug, you know, that sort of thing. And she just said that was the hardest thing she remembers because she couldn't. And she remembers looking over to the ridge at Strathewen and that she just
thinking, you're right there and my sister's right over there and I can't even hold her or touch her or comfort her.
And I think I shared a lot of details with her and some that I probably shouldn't have, but I think I suppose she was outside that inner circle that listened to me and I suppose the things that I told her that I had no idea I told her, I thought, oh, Jesus Christ. Oh my God, what have I done? Yeah. And because of my frantic insistence on that first phone call of making her promise that she leaves whenever there is fire, by her own admission, she has become super hypervigilant to the point of paranoia whenever there's fires around. And
that's the ripple effect that I'm talking about, you know, and Lauren would be one of, you know, just so many. And you know, your mum and dad probably wouldn't say anything to you because that, you know, maybe they don't want to worry you, but the ripple effect of that phone call you made to your mum, for instance, and it's funny you talk about you can't believe what you told Lauren. I think every now and then as police you have to keep a lot of things to yourself because you think, why would I bring somebody into that traumatic, grief-stricken world of what I've seen and everything. But sometimes you just get so full of grief and that you've got to unwind or unload on somebody. And I get that. I have, as you know, my two sisters, I feel I've probably told them too much in my time as well. And I know stuff that I've told them and a couple of really close girlfriends, I know I shouldn't have. But I needed to, but unfortunately my sisters and my girlfriends have never forgotten what I've told them either.
I mean, Paul's got different recollections.
Yeah.
Fozzie and Pete have got different recollections. I mean, we're all there together and we've all seen different things that affected us in different ways. So, yeah, it's just, it's interesting.
Mm. Well, I want to say thank you for sharing a story which needs to be told and it needs to be heard. The community really need to know how difficult policing can be. The police have got a hammering lately and from a personal viewpoint, I think totally justified. But on the other hand, there's so many members out there doing tasks like Black Saturday, which few hear about, particularly, you know, somebody like yourself that has been through something that none of us would ever want to go through. And I just want to say that your courage in sharing such a harrowing experience is something I think everyone out there will appreciate and thank you. It's been tough, hasn't it? We've had to have a couple of breaks when the social isolation finishes and all that. I'm going to come up there and I'm going to give you the biggest hug, heartfelt hug that I can. Thank you, my friend, not just from me but from all of Victoria. You're a hero. You really
no.
You are.
No.
And Foles and Pete. Thank you.
Thanks for having me and thanks for listening.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. made in association with the Acast Creator Network. We'll be back next week. Take care.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.